All right. Well, we are starting the book of Ecclesiastes, and I'm probably far too excited about this. This is definitely one of my favorite books in all of Scripture, and I hope that you're familiar with it, and I hope that what you're going to hear over the next 8 weeks or so, I hope it's, how do I put this? I just hope that it brings you to a place where you appreciate the book half as much as I do, and I hope it, depending on how you've heard it read or how you've heard it taught before, I hope that you walk away, as Chris asked at the very beginning, is this going to be depressing? I hope you're surprised. I hope you're surprised by the message of Ecclesiastes that is there to hear if we just listen very closely. So I'm excited about it. I can think of no better way to start off a series on Ecclesiastes than with Alanis Morissette. See if see how loud this is. This takes me back. I was five. I would ask you all to sing along, but that would really upset the class next door, so. Yeah, what's happening now? All right, so I'm going to play the whole song for you, but who is old enough to know Jagged Little Pill isn't ironic? So most hands, okay, so most people, like, who owned the album? Three? Okay, all right, fair enough. Okay, so look, this is, we're going to have more music later. All right, so this is what she's singing. If you couldn't catch all the lyrics, she says, an old man turned 98, he won the lottery and died the next day. It's a black fly in your Chardonnay, it's a death row pardon 2 minutes too late. Isn't it ironic, don't you think? It's like rain on your wedding day. It's a free ride when you've already paid. It's the good advice you just couldn't take. And she's got this sad story here. Mr. Play It Safe was afraid to fly, packed his suitcase, kissed his kids goodbye. He waited his whole darn life to take that flight. And as the plane crashed down, he thought, well, isn't this nice? And then she goes on. And this is the chorus. And then it's a traffic jam when you're already late. It's a no smoking sign on your cigarette break. It's like 10,000 spoons when all you need is a knife. It's meeting the man of my dreams and then meeting his beautiful wife. She keeps going. Isn't it ironic? So Alanis Morissette. And so before we get into, you know, debating and discussing how her use of irony is ironic, we won't discuss rhetorical literary devices this morning, but for another time. So, but she's on to something, isn't she? I mean, like what she's describing, we've all seen, and it's kind of like this is how life operates, and it doesn't seem like that's how life should operate. It's not how it should work, right?
It doesn't all happen at the same time.
What's that?
It doesn't all happen at the same time.
No, it doesn't all happen at the same time. Like what she's describing? Yeah, no, it doesn't. So let's come up with a different word. But she's onto something. So life isn't necessarily ironic in that regard, although it can be. But instead, let's try something else. Let's try this. Life is absurd. Can I use that word? We'll use that one. So you don't have to take my word for it. Let's discuss what absurd means. So anyone know this handsome fellow? He looks dashing, doesn't he? He's French. Anybody? You can say it out loud. It's okay. Camus, yeah. Yeah, it's not Camus. Kind of looks like it. Yeah, yeah. So Albert Camus, and he writes this book, very famous book, called The Myth of Sisyphus. Anybody know The Myth of Sisyphus? Yeah, one of you in the back, James. Or Chris. I said James, yeah.
Greek mythology, yep. To push a large boulder at the beginning of the day all the way up to the end of the day.
Yeah.
Reaches the peak, and then as soon as the sun starts to go down, it rolls down until all the time.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the curse of Sisyphus, other than his name. Middle school is not easy on poor little Sisyphus. So Sisyphus, yeah, he's condemned by the gods to roll this boulder up the hill. And then, of course, it rolls back down, and then he has to roll it back up for all of eternity. And so Camus, he writes this, he explains it. He says the gods had condemned Sisyphus to ceaselessly rolling a rock to the top of a mountain whence the stone would fall back of its own weight. They had thought, with some reason, that there is no more dreadful punishment than futile and hopeless labor. And now Camus is then going to apply this, and he's going to say, this is what life is like, and this is why life is absurd, the way he describes it. He says that man stands face to face with the irrational. He feels within him his longing for happiness and for reason, and the absurd is born of this confrontation between the human need and the unreasonable silence of the world. And he's going to describe this. Let me give you one more part here. He says there are absurd marriages, challenges, rancors, silences, wars, and even peace treaties. For each of them, the absurdity springs from a comparison, okay, between a bare fact and a certain reality. The absurd is essentially a divorce. It lies in neither of the elements compared. It is born of their confrontation. Okay, so here's what he's saying. For Camus, life doesn't make sense, okay, specifically because it is unreasonable. Life consists of innumerable contradictions between what we expect and then what we get. Life doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And nowhere is this more evident than in the reality of death. And death was the big problem that Camus was facing. He was trying to explain, if you will, how we understand death. So we make plans, we dream of the future, we plan for tomorrow, we put away money, we do all of these things as though we're never going to die, but then we die. And Camus says, what's that? What's about that? And so once you realize that death is certain, according to Camus, you realize that life is absurd. It's meaningless. It doesn't make sense. Someone might say it's a chasing after the wind. And again, just like Alanis Morissette, she was on to something. I think Camus is on to something. That the longer you live, the greater you feel the sense that life doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And we're longing for something that will finally give us this fulfillment, this deep longing, this deep satisfaction that we're longing for. And yet somehow it always seems to evade our grasp. It always seems elusive, just out of reach. And so what the world promises, what the world holds out to us, it never delivers. It never comes through. And so what we find here is this contradiction. The reality of life, the absurdity of life, that nothing delivers the way that it says, and the way that we hope, and the way that we expect. Okay. And C.S. Lewis points this out in Mere Christianity. He says, there are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give fulfillment to you, but they never keep their promise. There is always something we grasped at in that first moment of longing that just fades away in the reality. The spouse may be a good spouse. The scenery has been excellent. It has turned out to be a good job, but it has evaded us. Everything we chase after ultimately reveals itself to be less than what we'd hoped for. And so says the writer of Ecclesiastes. And that's what we're going to unpack over the next few weeks. But let's begin at the beginning. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. So stop there just for a moment. Let's acknowledge from the outset that this doesn't sound like the rest of the Bible. Utterly meaningless. Wait a minute. Isn't the whole point of the Bible to show us meaning, to show us that there is meaning? And yet here he's saying this is utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. It doesn't leave anything out. Everything is meaningless. This doesn't sound like the Proverbs, where if you do these things, then life turns out this way. If you just live wisely, then everything will work out and life will go well. That's the message of Proverbs. And yet Ecclesiastes, this doesn't sound right. And in fact, if you keep going, it just gets worse. We'll see in the weeks ahead. Adam Aswine writes in Recovering Eden, Ecclesiastes sounds like a crazed man downtown. He smells like he hasn't bathed, looks like it too, and as we pass by, he won't stop glaring at us. It's the ravings of a madman. That's what it sounds like. Clearly, something is going on in this book that's very different from the rest of Scripture. Okay, so let's go back here. The words of the teacher. Who are we dealing with here? We have to at least begin here with who is the teacher. So the traditional view of Ecclesiastes is it was written by Solomon, and there's reasons for that. I mean, one, he identifies himself as a son of David, king in Jerusalem. Also, later on, he'll refer to himself as being the wisest man, either to ever live or basically like one of the wisest men. And then in chapter 2 especially, you'll hear descriptions of what he's done and things that he's been part of that would fit with maybe some of our expectations or what we know of the life of Solomon. And so that's been the traditional view for, you know, always. And if you look in ancient Jewish writings, this is the traditional view that they hold as well, that Solomon, so if you remember the life of Solomon, he ends up marrying all these foreign wives and he falls into idolatry. And then what they believe is that he then came back and wrote this book after God sort of got a hold of his life. And he came back after reflecting on all of his life up to that point and all the mistakes and all the emptiness that he'd been part of. And then he goes, now I'm going to write this book. Okay. So that's the traditional view. Since the 17th century, there was a rise of what we call literary criticism. And this is looking at Scripture, the tone, the writings, comparing them to other writings, looking at the words, vocabulary that's being used. And since the 17th century, overarching scholarship has argued that it was not written by Solomon. And that's conservative or non-conservative. So before you go, well, those liberals, that's across the board. Within scholarship, the most widely held, very, very popular view is that Solomon did not write this. Now, that might bother you. That might be, wait a minute, hold on. It says that it's son of David. There's a number of reasons why scholars hold that position. Most of it has to do with, again, as they're analyzing the words themselves, the tone, comparing it to other passages, they go, this doesn't fit the writings of the day, and so on. Probably the most convincing argument that I've heard for this comes from Trimper Longman. He's an Old Testament scholar and commentator theologian. Sorry?
Westmont College.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Woo. I don't know what your mascot is, but we, you know. You don't even know. Okay. All right. Big into sports there. You didn't have a fault. There you go. Trimper Longman argues that and so he's a conservative, evangelical believer, follows Jesus, loves Jesus. He's going to argue that this was not written by Solomon because he sees this is being written in the same form of a genre of literature common of royal, what does he call it? Hold on, let me look at my notes here. Royal fictional autobiographies. And this is where someone would intentionally write in the voice of someone who had come years before, a famous person, in order to make a case or to tell a story, to make a particular point. It wasn't intended to deceive people into saying, oh, Solomon actually wrote this. Everybody knew it, Solomon didn't write it. The point was, I'm going to write in the voice of Solomon because I want to make a case here that if I use this voice, you'll understand it more clearly. It was a literary device to drive home the argument more profoundly. So his point here is that, this is Trimper Longman, he says, the person who calls himself Kohelet, that's the Hebrew word for the teacher, pretends to be Solomon in order to argue that if Solomon cannot find satisfaction and meaning in life in these areas, then no one can. Okay, so whether you hold to a Solomonic authorship or whether you don't, not really a huge problem to me. If you are bothered by the idea that it wasn't Solomon, then believe it's Solomon, because that's a traditional view that's been held by a lot of people. If you read more scholarship, don't be surprised if most don't hold to Solomon having written it. But it's not really a problem for our understanding of Scripture and even for inerrancy. So if you're thinking, well, this is somebody lying, again, if you understand the genre of the book and the intention behind the book, then inerrancy really isn't an issue. Any questions on that?
So they don't know who it was. We don't.
Most scholars don't think that we have any idea who it was.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Literarily, that's not uncommon either. Even now, I mean, even you talk about Camus in The Stranger, he writes it.
Right, in The Stranger, he writes it. Yeah.
It's not him.
Yeah.
And he's not trying to fool anybody.
Yeah, so everybody knows.
Literary
technique. Yeah. Yeah. What is it with philosophers? Kierkegaard does that. I mean, yeah. Okay. All right. So the next word we got to deal with here is meaningless. Meaningless. This is the Hebrew word hevel. And it's translated probably, if you're looking at your Bibles, you're usually going to see it as vanity or meaningless. The teacher here, though, when he's describing meaningless, we have to shift a little bit out of a philosophical mindset in the sense of like undergrad philosophy, and you read Nietzsche and you're like, oh my gosh, life is meaningless. It's not really what he's saying here. He's not saying that there's nothing to believe in. He's not saying that there's no point to life, that there's no meaning for life in that sense. He's not reading Nietzsche, okay? Instead, he has something very different here, and I think more profound and certainly more significant for our understanding, that what he's trying to get at is this idea of satisfaction and fullness. He's trying to get at this idea of the chasing after the wind, that we have this longing, this ingrained longing for satisfaction and for fullness and for completeness and for joy that we can never seem to grasp hold of. And that all the things that we chase after, all the things that we look for, ultimately fall short. There's an emptiness to them, if you will. It also carries this sense of a vapor, of brevity. It's like you might grasp it for a second, but then it's gone. Life itself is like that, right? Our life is a vapor. And so even when you find the greatest love or the greatest job, or you find those things that for a moment there, you taste happiness, you taste satisfaction, you taste a joy you've been longing for, that it's fleeting, and it doesn't last. It's elusive, okay?
Isn't that from one of the curses in Genesis, the frustration of life?
It is. We're actually going to talk about that. All right, so life doesn't work the way it's supposed to. That's his point. Life doesn't work the way it's supposed to. It's absurd. And so when we get to verse 3 here, he's giving us kind of a summary of really where the rest of the book is going, that he's going to unpack. Verse 3, he says, what does man gain from all his labor? This idea of gain here carries a sense of make a profit, but he doesn't just mean money. I mean, he could say, he's not just talking about like you worked really hard and you made the money. He's saying there's still something that's missing, right? There's this longing for satisfaction that we don't get. Something much more profound than just money. And then he says, under the sun, which we toil for under the sun. Toil here refers, I love this quote from one scholar. He says, it's tiresome effort expended over an enterprise of dubious result. Read that again. Tiresome effort expended over an enterprise of dubious result. You just keep working. It's weary. Just keep doing it. Under the sun here refers to life as we know it. There are some who you're going to hear and you'll read that will say, well, what he's getting at here is that under the sun means that when God isn't part of the picture, that God is nowhere to be found, then life under the sun is this frustration and absurdity and so on. I actually don't think that that's what he's saying because of how I understand meaningless. I think that what he's saying is that even with life under the sun, even with God in the picture, what we experience is the universal human condition, that we long for things, we fight for things, we strive for things, we toil for things, and yet they never satisfy. Okay? It's still the same. This is still the problem that we have, even as believers. Okay? As one scholar puts it, the absurdities taint all. Whatever we find, however good it is, the absurdity is still there. We still feel that tension. And so the question that he's raising here, that the rest of the book is going to answer in the negative, is what do we gain from all this labor? What do we gain from all this labor for which we toil under the sun? And he's going to say, in a sense, nothing. In a sense, nothing. It will not last. It will not satisfy. Life is fleeting, elusive, and quickly lost, no matter how great we find it for a moment. Everybody happy so far? Yay! All right, so we got to pause here for a moment, though, because here he's doing something that we could easily miss. He's up to something. He's very subtly referring back to something else, and this is what Alan was getting at. Because what he wants to do here in this language that he's using, what does a man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? He's pointing his back to something. And he's pointing his back to Eden. So this is expulsion from the Garden of Eden by Thomas Cole. And on this side, it's a beautiful painting. On this side, this is Eden. You can see it's all green and lush and wonderful. And then over here, you've got these two little people. And they are being sent out of the garden. And so where the teacher wants us to go is back to Genesis 3. It says, to Adam, God said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. So what's he saying? What's he saying? There's two results of the curse. One is toil. There's a futility of life. You will toil, you will work, you will struggle, and you will get nowhere. Ever feel that in your job? Yeah, sometimes that happens, right? You'll strive and you will labor, but it will never be enough. And then secondly, death. You came from dust, and now to dust you're going to return. These are the two results. And so guess what the teacher's big problem is? Guess what the teacher wants to point out to us? It's the same two things. That there is a futility of life that we experience. It's toil. It's wearisome. And it never ends. And we never really get anywhere. Because at the end, what's the second problem? You're going to die. And what he wants us to know is that we're not in Eden anymore. Futility is our lot in life. And it will only end in death. Futility and death, that's it. That's our lot in life. And so now he's going to go on and he's going to give us several verses. We're going to look at just a few of them where he's going to begin to give us a preview for where he's going to go in the rest of the book. But he's going to kind of give us a synopsis right here at the beginning to make his point. So the first thing he says is this: generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. In other words, you're going to die and no one's going to remember you. God, that's such good news. All right. So I just thought it'd be fun to play a little game real quick here. So anybody know who this is? Yeah, see, you have no idea. Guess what? No, not Thomas Jefferson. But you know what? He was a president. He was the 10th president of the United States. And yet we have no idea who this guy is. He also led the annexation of Texas into the Union. And yet you have no idea. This is where we live. You have no idea who this guy is. Anybody still? Tyler, thank you. Yeah. Everybody's like, I knew that. Yeah, yeah. You're thinking, well, that's so long ago. I mean, we can still look him up on Wikipedia. That's true. That's so long ago. So just we'll give you a more recent example. You'll all know who this is, but I love asking my kids. Yeah, right? Remember when this guy was someone? Yeah. Sure he is. He has a what? A DIY? No way. No, I didn't know that. Evidently, he's much cooler than I knew. But what I like to do is just, you know, give your kids, like, did not do it? Here goes. Just like, I know. I was just told that. Dude, I'm up. Oh, man, my kids are like, what on earth is this? That was random. Okay. All right. So generations come and generations go. The earth remains forever. You're going to die. And no one's going to remember you. Give it a little bit of time. So I was a few weeks ago, I was at my sister's house, and she was doing some project with her kids. And so they put up a family tree. And there were names on that that were my great grandparents, yeah, who I didn't even know their names. I knew them by what they were called by their grandkids, but I didn't know their names. And their parents, not a clue, no idea. So what, 3-4 generations? I have no idea who any of them are. I think about my grandparents, who my kids never met. And I'll tell them names, I'll tell them some stories, but they have no idea. This is the hard reality. This is what he's doing. He's trying to wake us up. This is the reality of life, and it's not fun. Generations and come and generations go. The earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. So now he's gonna say, look, this is as it is for us, so it is in all of nature. And if you think nature doesn't feel this, then you're confused. If you think that nature is like making progress or something, it's not either. In fact, this word hurries right here, translate hurries, this word in the Hebrew has a sense actually of a negative connotation. It's like perpetual drudgery. This is the sun. And it's like, I'm rising again. Back to where I started. Rising again. Back to where I started. That's how he's depicting the sun. That the sun feels the same weariness day in and day out. It's not just the sun, it's the wind. The wind blows. But it's just going round and around and around and around. It doesn't get anywhere. Anybody see The Secret Life of Pets 2? Yeah, so I've got little kids. Great quote from the hamster on the wheel. I run and I run and I run and I get nowhere. This is nature. It blows and it blows and it blows and it gets nowhere. All the streams flow into the sea and the sea is never full. It just keeps flowing to the place the streams come from. There they return again. Just as the sun and the wind, so water, the rivers, they flow, but it's never done. Whatever is done is quickly undone and then must be done again. And so the teacher concludes, look, all things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye has never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. In other words, whatever you're looking for even, like you just keep seeing stuff and seeing stuff and seeing stuff. You're never like, oh, well, that was enough. I'll just close my eyes forever. Like you just keep eating. You keep hearing. We run and we run and we run and we get nowhere. And so what he's saying here, look, as it is in nature, so it is with us. It's both ways. That just as in nature, it just keeps perpetually repeating itself over and over and over again. This is our lot in life. This is work. This is getting up every day. This is brushing your teeth. This is whatever you found joy in over time becomes drudgery. Nothing ever changes. Nothing is ever enough. We are the hamster in the wheel. Now, you might read this and think, well, you know what? On the bright side, there's always like new things around the corner. You know, we'll just keep having another day and another day and another day, but who knows what I might discover tomorrow. You know, tomorrow could be all kinds of new things. And the teacher says, oh, you're so naive. What has been done will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new. It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. Now you're thinking, wait a minute. I have an iPhone, college football, air travel, space. There's lots of new things, okay? But he's not talking about human innovation. He's talking about the human condition. He's saying the things that we're actually trying to solve, right? That satisfaction, that longing, that fulfillment, all of our innovation can't touch those things. We haven't found a cure for the human heart, right? Sinfulness, broken relationships, all the things that we're truly longing for, those things that we keep trying to innovate to solve, they're still there. It never changes. Right? So think of it this way. We come up with new ways to entertain ourselves, and yet we're never satisfied. Right? There's always more entertaining that we need. That's what he's getting at. Okay. And then he concludes with this. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. So he's right back where he was. Here's your lot in life. You will toil, you will work day in and day out, and however successful you think you are, it won't be enough, and then you'll die. All right, well, that's all I got for this morning, all right? So why is he telling us all this? Is it to depress us? Is it to discourage us? Is that what he's trying to do? I think he wants us to take the red pill. That's what I think. I think he wants us to take the red pill. I think he wants us to wake up. I think what he wants us to realize is that we live in a fantasy world. We live under these illusions that we can control our lives, that we will live forever, that all the things that we strive for and work for, that they will bring us satisfaction and longing that we're looking for. And I think he wants to wake us up to the fact that we do not live in Eden. We live outside of Eden. And outside of Eden, life is absurd. Life doesn't work the way it's supposed to. That we're going to die. We're going to work and work, and we're not going to get anywhere. We're going to make money and can't take it with us. You're going to find love and lose it far too soon. Life outside of Eden cannot satisfy because it isn't Eden. And here's the problem. We can't go back. And so what we spend our time doing with all that striving, what we're really trying to do is create Eden for ourselves. We're trying to recreate it, and we can't. And so what Kahelet wants us to see is that he wants us to know what is absurd, what is meaningless, so then we'll know what isn't. The first thing he has to do is show us how much of an illusion we live in. He wants us to stop playing make-believe. He wants us to stop playing pretend. Stop pretending that we're going to live forever. Stop pretending that all of the striving is going to get somewhere. He wants us to break us out of this illusion that we are in control, that we're gods. And so what he's doing here, it's like he's telling us the truth. It's like a pinprick to wake us up. He's going to make us bleed a little bit. He's going to make us hurt a little bit. He's going to slap us a little bit. It's like, oh, I thought that's what my life was. And he says, no. You thought that's what life was, but let's deal with reality that you want to deny, that you don't want to see. That, by the way, our society works really hard to convince you isn't true. We work really hard in society to believe that all of those things will make us happy, and that also we're never going to die. Perpetual youth. You know, years ago within communities, we cared for aged people. There was nothing else to do. Now we hide them away. And there's sometimes, I'm not saying you should never put anyone in a nursing home. There's care that can be provided, okay? But understand, there's a fundamental shift that has happened within society where it's like, if somebody gets old, we don't want to see that. We don't want to see death. We don't want to see the ugliness of it. We don't want to deal with that. And so it keeps us from having the same pinprick that the Ecclesiastes writer here is trying to remind us of. And so he's doing us a favor. He's trying to say, hey, you think this is life, and it's not. It's not. Let me tell you what life is really like. But here's the unexpected part. This is the part that we didn't see coming, or at least I didn't see coming for a long, long time, is that after the painful prick, after the painful reality of knowing that life is toil and wearisome and then we're going to die and be forgotten, actually, there's great joy. See, the teacher isn't telling all this to discourage us. He's not telling us all this to depress us. He's not having an existential crisis. He's not wandering around wailing, oh my goodness, life is meaningless. Oh, what are we going to do? No, remember, what is he? He's the teacher. So he's telling us something because he wants us to begin to understand something. And he's going to take the entire book to do it. But again, let me give you a little preview. I don't think he's trying to depress us or discourage us or anything like that. I think he's trying to set us free. I think he's trying to set us free from our illusions. He's trying to free us from striving after the wind. He's trying to free us from pretending that this life is more than it is, and instead discover the joy that comes when we realize that life isn't all it's supposed to be, that this isn't Eden, but there's a second Eden coming that we don't create. If I can boil it down, I'll put it this way. I think there's great joy when we realize that the weight of the world doesn't rest on our shoulders. That all that perfection that we're fighting for, all that we're trying to control, all that satisfaction we're trying to create, trying to make our perfect little lives and our perfect little children, our perfect little homes and our perfect little bank accounts and perfect little savings accounts and everything set up exactly the way it's supposed to be. He says, stop. That's an illusion. There's joy when you realize that that's not possible. So take a deep breath and stop taking yourselves so seriously. That's what I think his message is. So that's where we're going to head over the next 8 weeks. That's what I've got for this morning. I've got a few minutes, so comments, thoughts, questions? Anybody, are we still as depressed as we were? I hope we're you know, it's going to take all 8 weeks to get fully out of the depression, but yeah.
Is the under the sun phrase meaning here on earth rather as opposed to what's in heaven? Mm-hmm. Meaning?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. So what he's saying here is that this is my take. Not everyone agrees with this. Andy Wildman doesn't agree with this. So smart people. What I think is that what he's explained here is the plight of life. And it's the same whether you're a believer or you're not a believer. It's the same plight. The beauty of being a believer is that we are able to take the red pill, is that we're able to be woken up to this reality that this life, it doesn't change the fact that this life is absurd in that sense. We long to live forever and yet we're going to die. You know, we life feels like it should work certain ways. We do things, we plan things, we try to make things the way they should be, and they don't work out. That's true whether you're a believer or not a believer. So I think under the sun is simply saying that's life. This is where we are under the sun, but there's another Eden that's coming, and I think that's where ultimately, as believers, our hope lies. Right? Yeah, Steve.
And in verse 7, he says, all streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is not full.
Yeah.
When I read that, I wonder if perhaps part of what he's saying there is we misunderstand the point of the streams flowing. Mm. I mean, we think as humans, oh, it's because the seas need to be full. I mean, you know, or we think certain things need to take place. I don't know. Maybe he's saying that you believe that this is happening for this purpose, and this is happening for this purpose. I'm telling you, it's not for that purpose necessarily. I don't know.
I don't know. I haven't thought of it in that way. I mean, within the context, as far as I've taken it, is just that repetitive drudgery. You know, it's like we're just doing it again and again and again. But so something along the lines of like, I do think you're right, though. I mean, there's something, and he's going to allude to this later in the book of just we miss out what the, you know, we're missing the point,
yeah.
Right? So that's certainly true. But I haven't thought about it in that way. Yeah, James.
Does C.S. Lewis refer to what kind of we're talking about a little bit when he's talking about you taste the great music, it's unsatisfying, but it hints at something outside?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep.
There is one gigantic missing piece in the entire book, though, and that's the gospel of Jesus Christ. That hadn't taken place yet.
Yeah.
So when you fit that into Ecclesiastes, you go, yes, all this stuff is meaningless, but there is a point, and there are things that are eternal.
Mm-hmm.
And we will have that eternal.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think that even as a believer reading this, I certainly know that to be true, and yet I also recognize that it's easy, even as a believer, to live as though it's not.
Yep.
It's easy for me as a believer to fall into chasing after the wind. Absolutely. And I think there's a, you know, next week, looking at chapter 2, and everything that Solomon describes chasing after, you know, he's going to have wealth and gardening and, you know, which is high on my list, and sex and pleasure and all these kind of things. Well, geez, like no believer has ever fallen into those traps, you know. So I think that's why it's still so relevant. But yeah, no, it's there is eternity we're looking forward to. Yeah.
It's kind of like the Screwtape Letters theme of Satan and just wants to distract you to a different way. Like if you chase after this, if you fall after this, yes, praying is good, but you know what? You're hungry too, and so he's trying to like point you in different ways. And a lot of people we know do their entire life after one goal.
Yeah.
And then they get it and they're like, okay.
Yeah. Why did I do that? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Matrix metaphor is a really good one because it's like the great deception is that these things will lead to satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's like we're living in the Matrix where the visible things feel satisfying,
mm-hmm.
but ultimately they're not going to be.
Ultimately, you're asleep.
Yeah.
So and even believers get deceived by
it. Absolutely. I do. I mean, I think that's true of all of us at some degree and at different times. And I think that's the beauty of you know, being woken up. You realize it.
Just a quote I was thinking of, having just done Macbeth, where Lady Macbeth says, "Naught's had, all spent, when our desire is got without content."
Mm.
And, you know, that's Shakespeare and so many other writers recognizing the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. We see, you see it. I mean, this is not, this is the universal experience, you know, the human condition. And yeah, a lot of people, believers and non-believers, have written about this. And what do we do about it? I mean, this is, you know, Camus, not a believer. And so he's wrestling going, okay, look, we have a huge problem here. That is death. Death is coming, and death is what ultimately makes life absurd. And so he sort of, I mean, he's really debating, like, should we just kill ourselves? And ultimately he says, no, we don't do that. And he finds his meaning in like what he's going to refer to as sort of like this ultimate freedom. It's like, it's got to be freedom. And he says, what you can't do, what's cheating, is to play the God card. So Camus, not a believer. He's going to say, well, you're inventing these myths so that you feel better about your coping with your reality. And then he's also going to reject Nietzsche's, well, we just, you know, pure nihilism or something like that. So he's going to try to find his own middle ground. But essentially, yeah, yeah, his philosophy, yeah.
The reason that Adam and Eve were taken out of the garden was so they wouldn't eat of the tree of life. So
yeah.
They wouldn't stay in sin for eternity. So God was actually trying to use death as a tool for him to say, like, you are not stuck in this ball forever.
Yes.
Like, everybody will have to get out of the ball and go somewhere.
Yeah. I think there's a beautiful, I love that you brought that up, because I think there's a beautiful tension here where death is evil. Death is an enemy. Scripture makes that very clear when you get into Paul's writings, Revelation, and even the work of Jesus. I mean, death is not our friend, but God uses the knowledge of death in our lives even to sort of, again, kind of wake us up. And you see this with Adam and Eve. It's like, hey, in this case, this is an evil, but I'm going to protect you in this way from being stuck in this reality that is obviously separate from me, right?
But isn't it interesting that he gave us a deadline? So haven't you ever worked to something, but you needed a deadline in order to make it happen?
Yeah, that's a great point, yeah.
So he didn't have to tell you what it was.
Yeah.
He wanted you to know that it will always be a deadline.
Yeah, it's coming.
But you can't procrastinate to the end of it because you might miss it, right?
Yeah.
So he gave you that, like,
deadline. Yeah, yeah. As long as you know it's a dead line, as Wes said. Yeah. All right, we gotta stop.